Hey up, it's the No Nay Never podcast with your host, Jamie Smith.
Hello and welcome to this week's No Nay Never podcast. I'm Jamie Smith and with me today are James, Adam and Michael. Just one game to go through today, which is a bit of a shame compared to the recent podcast, but it was a win, a 2-1 victory over QPR at Turf Moor, so let's get straight into it. Very, very good result in a massive game, Michael. It was difficult to understate how vital it was that we got that win.
Massive result, mate. It's one of the happiest I've been this season after a game, just because of the importance of it. But we're going to stay up this season if we can beat the teams around us. Yeah, it doesn't matter how you perform against, well, it doesn't matter how you perform against the top half of the table, but beating them teams around us is what's key. You only have to look at the points difference now between, I think it's 19th and 12th, or something like 3 points. So, huge, huge result.
It's psychological as well, isn't it, to be able to get out of that bottom three. And although we've been playing really well the last few games, we'd only won something like 1 in 9, I think, so it was really vital that we carried over that form into a game that we all knew was winnable and we all knew was going to be really important. But the fact that we got out of the bottom three and put QPR back in, I think that's really key, especially with the games that we've got coming up. Just a bit of a shame that Palace and Leicester won as well, so the impact was slightly reduced. And two really good goals that we scored as well, James.
Sensational. Particularly since, I think we've talked about it quite a lot recently, he seemed to have gone off the boil a little bit. And I think you could see how much it meant to him as well when it hit the back of the net. He looked like he was pretty close to tears, actually. And obviously the Ings won. I'm not really sure what either defender's doing, but you can't fault him for his footwork there to take it round and score.
Yeah, the emotion on Arfield's face, absolutely, you could tell that it was a big release, because he'll know that he's not been playing that well. I think I sent a tweet when I saw the team saying that I was a bit surprised Kyle wasn't in, and I know Kevin, who's on the podcast quite often, he's been calling for Kyle to come in, so Arfield proved us both wrong with a really, really excellent goal. Harry Redknapp complained about the defending, James has mentioned the defending. I suppose all goals to an extent are preventable, aren't they? But I think in Arfield's case in particular, he has beaten three players and bent it in the corner, so it's probably a bit harsh to criticise the defending a bit too much for that one, Michael.
Yeah, he's done brilliantly to turn him inside out, really. And then I think he was comparing it to, oh, we're not playing against Messi here. But he hands down, he turned him inside out and put it away. Yeah, maybe disappointed with how they defended against on the Ings goal, because it was just a knock forward. He's taken it down very well, showed good feet to get across, but back onto his left foot and then put it away. But that's what he needs in this division. You need that cutting edge. So you need to be able to take advantage of defensive errors, if you could call it that, which I don't think it was. I think it was just great play from both Ings and Arfield to bag.
I think the Ings goal, it's only bad defending initially. I think as soon as they let that ball bounce, then they're in trouble. But I think Ings has still beaten the two defenders, so I think you've got to give him a lot of credit. And although the finish didn't look that clean, it was probably about the only one that would have gone in.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Unless he's slicing it with the outside of his left foot into the bottom left, he'd have struggled to put that in. So he's scuffed it a bit, but it was the right shot. If he meant it, it was the right shot selection, really.
On that, I do think obviously you've got to give Ings credit, but at the same time, I think like you said, the original ball, just neither defender really seemed to know what they were doing, and as a result, he's got the time to take it down, and obviously he beats them both hands up. So he's still done very well, but I think if you were either of those defenders, you'd probably be looking at it after and going, why did one of us not head it?
Yeah, I think it was probably a bit of a case of an after you, wasn't it? And then by the time they decided whose job it was to get rid of it, it was already a bit too late and Ings was in. Just before Ings' winner, though, I think it's really important to highlight a save Tom Heaton made from Vargas, I think it was. It was probably the best save of the game. And it was at a period where QPR were probably having their best time in the match. They'd just got back on level terms with Charlie Austin's penalty. And I really feel like that Heaton save was a big turning point, because a couple of minutes after that, we were in front. And we're really starting to see from Heaton now, I feel, that he's he's joining the likes of Shackle and Trippier and Ings has been really, really comfortable at Premier League level. And I think he's been a bit underrated at times this season. People don't seem to have talked about how good he's been, but I think there was a stat that said he's only made one mistake that's made for, led to a goal, and that's the joint lowest of all goalkeepers in the Premier League this season. So really need to give a lot of credit for the goalkeeper who sets that solid base for the rest of the team, Michael.
I'm actually surprised you brought this up because I've got written down next to me, he's a bit of an unsung hero this season. So I think that sums it up. He's not had the praise he probably deserves. He has looked solid week in, week out. And I know for once in my life that I'm quite confident that Heaton's going to be able to deal. We've got a keeper that can deal with shots coming in on goal. He's not going to spill it out to someone or just like flap his arms a little bit. You can be pretty confident that with him, Keane and Shackle, we've got quite a solid base in the centre there. And alongside that, you've got Trippier. A bit of worry about the left-hand side, but it's a solid back line at the minute that we've got. And it's good, great to see, I think. But yeah, I think Heaton does deserve a lot more credit from the sides. It won't surprise me if he's up there at the end of the season in the Player of the Year category if he carries on how he is at the minute.
Heaton, as a player for us, has never actually been any different. I can't think of a time when I've never actually been confident in Heaton. From the Bolton game when he first joined us, the first game of the season, he's always impressed me. Like, but as fans, we've never really like sung his praises enough, really. So I don't think actually much has changed this season. But I suppose as we've moved up to the higher level that is the Premier League, his quality kind of shines through a little bit more.
I think it's just that you don't really want to notice your goalkeeper, do you? Ideally, he's not having to do much because you're protecting him and you're stopping the opposition from creating too many chances. But if he's not making mistakes, you're not noticing him as well. And I think Heaton just seems to give off an air of sort of quiet assurance. Like, everyone's really unconcerned about what he's going to do. You know he's reliable. He doesn't sort of come out and not get balls like a lot of goalkeepers. I think the only time that you could maybe criticise him for that was the goal against Liverpool, but Sterling's so quick you can understand why he won that foot race. James has just put a stat on our little chat thing saying that in fantasy football points, which is, as everyone knows, the most objective measure possible, Tom Heaton is the sixth best goalkeeper in the Premier League. So perhaps another to talk about in terms of potential England recognition in the future, although this season is maybe a bit too early. But there's so few English goalkeepers around, James. He's got to be mentioned in the conversation at some point, hasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, one of the guys he's ahead of right now is Joe Hart, only by one point. But, you know, there's not a lot of, you know, English keepers around. And I think most of the ones who are there have been in the frame before, sort of like Rob Green, etc. And they've not really shown much. So, you know, I think there's a chance there that one day he could be in the England squad. I think there's also obviously a chance that he could move on from Burnley if we don't stay in the Premier League.
You could probably say that for about half a dozen of our players, couldn't you? There's probably no point worrying about that at this stage. Something else I wanted to talk about from the QPR game was Charlie Austin, who, of course, got on the score sheet, as you'd probably expect, as he did at Loftus Road. We all agreed that it definitely was a penalty. There was some debate before people saw Match of the Day on Saturday night, but Dean Marnie's tripped him up, hasn't he?
So I can leave that one all side. Day.
All day long. Sorry, Marnie. Definitely a penalty.
But he's taken it well. He didn't have that many other chances. What did you make of his overall performance, Michael?
I think he was the weak link of the weekend, to be honest. He didn't impress me massively, but it wasn't like he was awful. He was just the poorer of the team, and that tackle probably summed it up. It seemed a bit of a needless tackle. He left his foot in, didn't need to, and put us under pressure by doing that. So I was a bit disappointed with his tackling at the weekend and how he played, but it's everyone's entitled to have an off day, to be honest.
I think Austin as well, he's the sort of striker who needs a lot of chances to be created, and QPR didn't really do that for him. He hit the post with one that was a bit of a half chance, and apart from that, he didn't really get many sights of goal. I think we restricted his chances quite well in that respect. And maybe the performance of Joey Barton, who I felt was really, really off his game on Saturday, maybe that had an effect as well because his supply line seemed to be cut off. a little bit. In the second half, James, when QPR were pushing for that goal, were you confident we were going to see it out? They didn't create an awful lot. We seemed to hold them at arm's length quite well.
I'm really glad you said second half then, not first half, because I only actually saw the second half. So, I thought we looked in control, to be honest, which possibly isn't something you say very often when you come under pressure like that. But I thought that we had it under control, and to be honest, I'm not really sure how we didn't get another in the second half.
I think all the home wins, actually. QPR, Southampton and Hull was the other one, wasn't it? I think all of those games, we've looked reasonably comfortable when we've got in front. I mean, you're always going to come under pressure when teams start putting more strikers on, but I was never that concerned that QPR were going to get another, even when Heaton had to make a save right at the end from, I think it was Colker's header. But yeah, it seems to be quite unruffled, and we probably should have had more goals, really. The Ashley Barnes one, what did you think of the Barnes one, Michael, the disallowed one for the foul on Rob Green?
Well, for me, at first glance when I watched it through, I thought, yeah, I can see why the ref's probably blown against him there. It's that whole, the old, keeper always gets the advantage in that situation. But then on second look of it, I think Barnes is the one that got fouled, to be honest. I think he was getting pulled back himself, and then I watched it again on Match of the Day, and I totally think that goal should have stood, because Barnes is the one that was getting pulled down initially. So a bit harsh on us, and I really think we should have had 3-1, to be honest. Not that I had a bet 3-1 Ings any time, but not bitter.
It's just a sign of the protection goalkeepers get, I think, isn't it? I mean, Hill on Barnes, he's hauling him about a bit, but you rarely see them given, whereas you go anywhere near a goalkeeper in the 6-yard box now and it seems to be a foul game every time. I think it was really unlucky, but we had plenty of chances to kill the game off after that. We seemed to squander quite a lot of breakaways, and I think Dash mentioned that clinical edge that we've talked about on the podcast before, and perhaps we should have put two or three more away. What do you reckon, James?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few chances there that, you know, we perhaps should have scored. I mean, on the Barnes one, I agree with Michael, I have no idea what that's been given for in the end. There's just some hands up, and I'm not really sure how you can judge that as a foul on the keeper. But, I mean, then you look at the Ings chance as well later on, where, you know, he looks in a really good position to score. He's timed his run absolutely perfectly. And then he just takes a bit too much of a heavy touch to take it around the keeper, and he's knocked it out of play.
Yeah, I wasn't sure what he's really trying to do with that one, because it seemed like he was too close to the goal to take it round Green. It felt like he should have just hit it as soon as he got in. It was almost like he was surprised that the ball came through. We don't seem to play a lot of those through balls, so maybe he wasn't expecting the ball to arrive, but that was a great chance. But there were a couple more breaks after that. I think Boyd got down the left once and didn't get his head up to get the cross in. There were a couple of really good chances, and on another day we could have got punished by an equaliser at the end, and maybe we were a touch fortunate that didn't happen. But I think overall 2-1 was probably a fair reflection of the game. I think we were certainly the better side, and although I think some of the QPR players and Redknapp might have said otherwise, that he thinks it was unfair, I think they're talking rubbish really. QPR players as well had a bit of a set two, shall we say, with their fans at the end. That's probably a good sign for us, isn't it, that one of our relegation rivals is coming apart a little bit. Of course, the defeat sent them back into the bottom three, and they haven't got a single point away from home yet. What did you make of QPR, Michael?
it's a bit comical, that whole situation when they were arguing away with each other, but I can understand the fans' frustration as well. If you were travelling, well, I don't even know how far it is to London, but if you've been travelling 10 games on the road and yeah, beat every other week and the performance is not improving, you can see why they're getting very annoyed. As for QPR as a side, I didn't think they showed enough to say that the out stay up. We had that bit more desire to want it, but then I guess they'd have said that same thing when we played them down at their place. So it's a really tough one to call at the minute, especially with how the league's teed up. But based on, if I were just going off what I saw on Saturday, I'd say they're just not good enough at this level at the minute, despite the players that they've got at their disposal. I don't know if that were down to players having off days, like you said. Barton wasn't great, he wasn't really at the races. Austin wasn't at his best. So I don't know if it's just down to one of them off days, but they're the games that you need to be up for if you're wanting to stay up. So yeah, I think they could definitely be in a deep battle if they don't turn, especially the away form around quickly, because it's just like us went in 09-10 when we went down.
It's even worse than we were. They haven't got a single point away from home yet. It's amazing. I think it's the first time a Premier League club has failed to get a single point from the first 10 away games. It's remarkable, really. You'd normally scab something by now.
I mean, so remember, it doesn't start Premier League, though. If you go back, I think it's the 60s, 60s or late 50s, one of them. Liverpool, 20 games unbeaten away from home, I believe, is the record.
Without a win, you mean?
Without a win, yeah. Away from home. Sorry.
Yeah. As anyone who watches Sky Sports knows, football started in 1992, so anything that happened before that just doesn't count. There's a long way to go, obviously, but this is the first time in a good few weeks that we have been out of the bottom three. QPR got sent back in there. Put you on the spot, James. Who would be your three to go down right now? Obviously, it changes by the week, doesn't it, really?
Yeah, I think if you look at the table now, I think those are likely the three teams that I'd think would go down. I mean, Leicester look, and obviously they've managed to get two wins from the last couple, but they look well and truly lost pretty much since they drew with us. And QPR, unless they win away from home, you can't see a way that a team can get through a season without winning away from home and staying up.
The thing with QPR for me is that I just can't see the home form lasting as well. I think the comparison to us under Owen Coyle is quite a good one, in that they're not getting anything away in the home results. They've just got to stop winning at home at some point. And QPR fans were pointing to a stat that said they haven't played anyone from the bottom eight or something away from home, but they've played at Turf Moor now and got beat as well, so they haven't even got that to grasp at anymore. I think QPR are going to find it really difficult. What about you then, Mac? Are you off three to go?
QPR's one of mine, I think. I just can't see them turning that form around. I can imagine them getting a bit trigger happy and maybe sending old Harry Packy in at some point if things don't pick up massively. And if that happens, I think it'd tie in with a drop in home form and see them really, really, really struggling. Leicester are an odd one for me. I think they picked up a couple of points recently, and depending how the new January signings gel, because I can imagine throwing a bit more money yet before the end of the window at it, if they gel well, they might just scrape out. I think Villa are in a bit of free fall at the minute, so I can imagine them finally going down. It's about time, because they've been hanging around there for a couple of seasons, and Hull City are just, they look a bit lost, so I can imagine them going as well.
I think Villa's problem is goals, isn't it? They've only scored a few all season, really, and it's difficult. I think it's 11 or something from 21, so half the games, really, not scored in. When you're struggling for goals, that is seems to be that when you go down. But the bottom half of the league is tight, as always. I mean, I think most of us would probably agree that Everton aren't realistic candidates to go down, but anyone below them, and you've got eight teams that could easily go down. Sunderland, I think, are well worth mentioning. They're really struggling at the minute, and our game up there in a few weeks' time is going to be big for both teams as well. For me, this run of games that we're on at the minute, I think this is when we need to get our points, because after these, the games start to look really hard, and I know you can get 3 points from anywhere if you're on your game, but the reality is if we can beat Palace and West Brom at home, then we're going to be well above the line for a few weeks.
Yeah, I think what you said about Everton is probably right, that's sort of the marker that you can say anyone below that could go down. I mean, Everton themselves have clearly scored too many goals to go down. They've scored 30 goals, and there's no way you can imagine a team who's scored 30 at this point going on to not score enough to pick up points. But what you said about Villa is, you know, incredible. I mean, they make us look prolific, and some people would say we've been lacking goals.
I think before the last few, we were comparable to Villa, but after scoring a few at City and a few at Newcastle, and then obviously two at the weekend, which was the first time we scored more than one at home all season, actually, so that's important. I think our goals have picked up, and our goal difference as well, I noticed, as other teams have slipped back a little bit, ours is now only the joint worst in the league, rather than being the worst by some distance, as it was for quite a time, so that's no longer worth another point against us. I think that's comparable to half a dozen teams, I think, looking at the table now, so that's not something to worry about too much. We'll come on to the Palace game a bit later in the programme, but that will be another big six-pointer, if you want to call it that, but we will mention that a bit later in the show. I want to talk about Sean Dyche now. Now, we tend to focus on the players on the podcast, if not on the website, and rightly or wrongly, I think we should have a different tack today, because it was 100 league games for our manager, and another victory, another home victory. Our home form has been pretty good generally under Dyche. So I want to talk to everyone who's on the podcast today and find out what they think has been a really defining factor in why we've succeeded so much under Sean Dyche in the last two and a bit years it is now. Adam, if we can start with you.
On Saturday night, I decided to finally change my tune and write another article for the site, an actual article, not a podcast summary or a live blog. And I was watching the press, the interviews on Sky after the game, and the difference between Dyche and Harry Redknapp just really highlighted to me what's so good about Dyche, and it's that he's so logical, and he's not. He never really engages in cliche. In a way, he has his own cliches because he says the same thing really often. But I think his almost hyper-logical approach, he solves any problem by looking at it on its merits. And I think that's really valuable in football, which is just obsessed with like kind of the emotional storylines, the great, the sort of superstition and emotion that everyone gets drawn into. And that's why we love the game, but it's also probably not the best way to deal with the game in terms of trying to get results out of it. And I think that is why Dyche has done so well with us.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I've been guilty of being a bit frustrated with some of the things that Dyche says, because he can talk a bit management speak at times, and sometimes it doesn't seem like what he's saying actually means anything when he comes out with stuff like market leaders, but he's got his little phrases that he likes, like being relentless, and I think they really underpin what the team's all about, so it clearly does mean something to the players, even if for some of us sometimes it's a bit of a head scratcher. Michael, if we can come on to you next, what's the defining factor been for you?
I think it's the scientific approach he takes to the game. He's one of these new breed of managers, as they're always called. I recall Steve Cotterill was called that at one point as well, but he's actually got the knowledge to back it up, I guess, where you look at who he's brought in since coming in. And I've actually got a friend who's on the technical team at the Turf who does the analysis, and they make great use of Prozone down at the Turf. Where they're going back down to Gawthorpe midweek, looking at how we've played, positions that we're taking up, the runs that players are making, and how they can improve their game. And I think that's really spilled out onto the training pitch as well, and the mentality that he's instilled in the players. And it all comes from this scientific backing, that basis that he's got to his management style. And a lot of the time he'll talk about how his players are he can rely on his players and the fitness, and that's why he's consistently picking the same team. And that is because it goes back to the same approach that he keeps bringing to it, and the training he employs, I think.
The sports science team, I think, deserve a mention at this point. I know it's a guy called Mark Howard does a lot of good work in that department, and all clubs probably do the same sort of statistical analysis now, but it's how much you take that into account, I suppose. And We tend to talk about stuff like substitutions and like bemoan why Dyche leaves it so long, but I've no doubt that that's a statistical decision that he's made, and we're just not privy to the numbers involved. James, you're next then.
I think a big part of it has been his desire, to use something that probably sounds like it's not an attribute for a football manager. It's clear that he knows what he wants to do. And that while everyone else may think it's not possible, he knows he can do it, and he's got that desire to make it work against what most people would say would be conventional thinking, that you can take a group of players who've been cheaply assembled and you know, stay up in the Premier League. But he clearly believes he can, and I think it's that belief and that desire to do it that is why he's been so successful so far.
I think if you compare him to someone like Harry Redknapp as well, I think that's really notable. The last couple of years, I don't think Redknapp's heart's really been in it, probably since he felt like he was going to get the England job and then didn't.
You know, I think desire can really help people perform above their level. I mean, obviously, Darsh has got that desire to do well, and I'd imagine that the players all have that desire as well. And part of that will be that it feeds off him.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. It certainly instills it in the players, doesn't it? And you talk about people like Scott Arfield and Ashley Barnes, who, with the greatest respect, they didn't have a massive amount of success before coming to Burnley and working under Sean Dyche, and he's managed to take them on to levels that probably nobody thought they were capable of. So that desire and belief has certainly been a factor there. One of the things I think has been important is the consistency of team selection. And you see a lot of managers in the Premier League in particular, they rotate their squad like it's something that they have to do. And I think we've proven that you don't necessarily need to do that. I think QPR was it the seventh league game in a row that the same teams played. We had a similar run last season. I think that was 8, 9, even 10 games where the same team played. Like, when the team news came in, it wasn't really news because you knew who was going to be playing. Unless there's an injury, we don't change it. I think that's really important because it means that after a while, everyone knows that their job's inside out. They get a feel of what everybody else is going to be doing, and you start to read what players are going to do in each situation. I think the combinations we've got all over the pitch, Marnie and Jones in central midfield, perfect fit, know each other inside out now. Barnes and Ings are starting to develop that partnership. At the back, Shackle and Keane, it's the same. Combinations down the wing, the same. Trippier and Boyd have got a really good understanding, and on the other side, Arfield and me work in a really good way as well. And I think if you're playing week in, week out, the same 11, that's how those partnerships get forged. And you see these teams that are shuffled about every week, and you just wonder if they're able to get that same sort of consistency. And I think that for me is one of the key reasons. And although sometimes we go, oh, why is Arfield still playing? He's not been playing that well. Keitel should get a game. Or when a cup game comes round, we'll go, well, this is a good opportunity to rest players and give the fringe players a game. But it's obviously really important to Dash that he has his settled team. Everyone knows their jobs inside out. And I think that's been really important. And although, for me, I think there's one or two changes that we could make to improve the side, Dash is obviously going to wait till there's an opportunity to do so. And then he'll make it when he feels it's the right time, rather than just making a change for the sake of it, which is what I feel like a lot of people do sometimes.
That point kind of linked back to everything else, because especially James's point about the desire. I think if you've got the consistency in the team selection and the partnership, you get that desire as a group. You get the whole group wants to fight for each other and have the desire, and it all links together quite nicely. Group, I said group. James has just pointed out on our little chat thing that I said group, and I'm obviously turning to Sean Dyche, which is what I tried to avoid in my article earlier.
That's what happens, though, isn't it? Everyone buys into what Dyche says, and saying stuff like being relentless, yeah, just sort of passes into a common phrase because it's been hammered into us for the last 2 years. So yeah, that was our little analysis of how we think Sean Dyche has done and why we all think he's been such a success. But I don't think it was important to recognise that 100 league games milestone, because we do tend to focus on the players, and it's about time Dash got a little bit of the spotlight as well. Moving on now then, there's two games to look at before our next podcast, which will be next Monday as normal. It'll be online Tuesday or Wednesday. The first game is Wednesday night against Spurs. Cup replay, probably none of us wanted, but it is another opportunity to get a win on the board and build some confidence, I suppose. Have just been talking about consistency of team selection. With such a big game on Saturday, are we expecting changes, or is it going to be the same again, assuming people are fit? What do you think, Michael?
It'll probably be the same again, I think. It's one of them games where at the moment I really couldn't care less about it. I kind of hoped towards the end of the game, when we played them last time, we'd have got beat, so we could have done without it. where it's landed in this run of very important games. Ideally, I'd like to see one or two players rested, just so then they are fresh to the game. But maybe Barnes for Volks, for example, Arfield for Kiteley, then a little change where you can be confident, maybe Lafferty for me, just a little change where you can be confident that the player coming in is going to be able to do the job while resting. Perhaps it's the players that he sees is key 11, essentially.
Yeah, I think the first game, he only made two changes, didn't he? One of those was enforced because Shackle had his injury, but I really felt Jones benefited from having that little rest. He has looked a bit tired at times, and I think the role he plays, it's really important to be 100%, otherwise you are going to be a little bit off it. And I felt his performance on Saturday against QPR was probably the best he's played all season. I thought it was absolutely fantastic. So if we do have the opportunity to do that with a couple of players and just freshen up the team a bit, and I do think Sam Volks would be a really good option if he is up for starting a game yet. I think that's something we could look to do, but I wouldn't be too surprised if Dyche does go the same again, because it is very Sean Dyche. What do you think, James?
Yeah, I don't think he's going to make an awful lot of changes. That's just been the way he's, I think he's always played with the cup competitions. But I won't be surprised if Tottenham do make quite a few, because obviously they've played, I think, the most games in the Premier League, out of the Premier League teams so far. And obviously they've got a lot more games to come, so you'd be thinking that they're looking at some of their players and they don't want to be getting too worn out. I mean, I think particularly since Eriksen played last time out, he might be someone who gets a bit of a rest since he's so key to their game.
Yeah, there was a stat going round on Twitter as well. I think it was a screenshot from Sky Sports about distances covered in the last few games. Obviously, George Boyd was top by a long way, because he's always going to be top by a long way, but Eriksen was actually second, and I was a bit surprised at that, because he doesn't really come across like a player who's running and energy doesn't seem to be a big part of his game, but he was second behind Boyd, and it just caught me by surprise. Maybe he'll be one that missed out. Kane didn't play at the turf, did he? So maybe he'll be rotated again. And Pochettino didn't seem to have an awful lot of respect for the cup competitions last year at Southampton, so it'll be interesting to see what sort of team Spurs put out. It's going to be our fourth time playing them in a month, actually, which is obviously quite unusual. A defeat at Spurs and the draw in the cup. Fourth time? Totally lost count. Anyway, we've played them a lot recently, which is the important thing. That has an impact sometimes, doesn't it, Michael? Because you learn about the opposition more than you do normally if you're only playing them twice a season. It'll be interesting to see if that does have an impact.
Yeah, it will be quite interesting. I can imagine with how Pochettino likes to change his team up, especially after the weekend. Yesterday's defeat, I think it was, against Crystal Palace. I can imagine he will change it up a little bit. Familiarity-wise, I don't know if it's one of them where they're looking and go, oh yeah, we've got them sussed pre-game, or whether or not. I can imagine Dyche just sitting the boys down and saying, look, it's just another game. Yeah, we've played them a bit, but it's just another game. Let's just take it how we would any other. So hopefully that's the case. Maybe we've learnt one or two tricks, ways to penetrate them a bit better. But I think after the game at the turf last time out, I think we could be confident in getting a result there. But we just have to wait and see. Like I say, I'm not actually that bothered about it.
No, I think the players are probably more up for a cup game than the fans are at this stage. Survival's obviously the big thing for us, but hopefully the players won't be tired from Wednesday going into the weekend game. You can't imagine it'd have that much of an impact. They don't seem to have been bothered by all the games at Christmas. Don't appear to have had that much of an impact. So, yeah, I expect maybe a couple of changes at the absolute maximum. But Spurs might rotate a bit more. Maybe that does give us an opportunity. Leicester City will be up next at home in the next round, which you'd probably see as a winnable game. There is an opportunity for a cup run there, although I'm sure everyone would take survival now over a cup run if it was offered. We'll move on to talking about Palace in a minute, though. We'll just do some predictions on Spurs first. I think, James, what do you reckon? Are we going to get anything there? Is it going to go all the way, or are we going to get beat?
I just want to be just stupidly ambitious and say we'll win 2-0.
Blimey. I don't know what to make of that. Michael?
1-1, extra time, penalties, then we'll probably get beat on penalties.
I think it might be a long night, and it's probably not what we're after. I think it might be extra time as well. I don't want to call which way it might go, though. The weekend game is another big one at Turf Moor. Crystal Palace are coming up this time, and they are another team you would probably put down as a relegation rival. They have got a new manager, though, and that new manager bounce did help them to beat Spurs at the weekend, as we have just mentioned in passing. And they came from behind to do that as well, which is perhaps a sign of a bit of belief that Alan Pardew has been able to put into his team. But on the flip side, they are missing a couple of important players as well. Jedinak is away at the Asian Cup, and Balassi is at the African Cup of Nations, and they are two of their better players. It's hard to know what to make of it when a new manager comes in, isn't it, Michael? But Pardew does seem a good fit there. He's got his past there. The fans seem to be on board. They seem like a club that could be turning a corner to me.
Yeah, it's almost like the Great Escape Mark II, isn't it, when they survived last season with Pulis, when he came in. And they do look like a team that buoyed. I watched them at the weekend, and I thought they were poor to begin with. They didn't look like they were in it, but then they just turned it around and come from nothing. So I'm really not sure what to make of them as a team, because I think on their off day, they are really poor. Then on a good day, they're good. But another thing you've got to take from it as well is they were at home at the weekend, and they've got that vociferous support at home, noisiest fans in the country or whatever. So I think that has a big factor on their ability to win games at Selhurst Park. So coming up to the Turf, I hope for God's sake that it's at our place. I'm not just talking crap here, but if it's up at our place, then yeah, I'm not even going to look at the fixture list.
It is at our place. We we drew at their place when Scarfield missed that penalty right at the end. Palace's form has been quite up and down. Just looking at their recent results now, they've won the last two since Pardew came in. But before that, they had goalless draws, then they lost a couple. They haven't won away for a long time. Everton, I think, was the last time they won away in September, so that has been a problem for them. They are level on points with us right now with a slightly better goal difference. So it would be another similar one to QPR in that if we won, we'd go above them. We've spoken a lot about this run of games, James, but it's so important, isn't it, to get points from these games, these home games, against teams that are also down there, because that's what the six-point thing means, isn't it? If we get the 3 points, it's 3 points that they can't get, and it just provides such a big confidence boost when you get one over on the teams around you as well.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, in an ideal world, what happens is we take points off everyone around us, and everyone around us draws with each other, and you know, no one's picking up 3 points while we are. But I think, you know, a key thing about particularly Palace is when you look back early in the season to the game at their place, it's one of the way really we should have got more out of it, and I just don't think you can allow yourself to drop points against them again, particularly at home. When obviously they are going to be one of the teams that are fighting down there with us to stay up.
It'll be interesting to see if Scott Arfield has another good game, actually, because there was a really good response, I think, from the players and the fans at Selhurst when he had that penalty saved at the end, but he was quite clearly devastated that he'd missed that chance to get us an extra 2 points, but he was much better against QPR. I think that's the best he's played since the first few weeks of the season, so hopefully he'll be out for revenge and he can carry that improved form into Saturday's game. Just mention the two players that they have got missing, Michael. They've coped without them in the Spurs game quite well. Jason Puncheon, I noticed, came in and played well. He had a really good run of form in the second half of last season. He seems to come alive in January for some reason. But Jedinak, their captain, who had a bad game against us at Selhurst, he holds their midfield together. They're certainly going to miss him, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, it's a big loss for them. He's one of them players which could probably come into our team and improve it. He is a really good player. And they are going to miss him, but it's like you said, Puncheon come in, and he was a real live wire at the weekend and showed the ability that he's got. And again, they've got Wilfred Zaha, who's since going back, he's been mixed form. He'll have one good game, one bad game, another good game again. It's a hard one when you've got them type of players on the bench that have got obvious quality, but not as consistent as, say, Jedinak is. So in that respect, they've lost that reliability that they know when they go out on the pitch, you can have a generally reliable player in Jedinak. So, yeah, they'll definitely be worse off for it, definitely.
It's quite interesting as well that Pardew's gone for Glenn Murray up front, who was a big player a couple of years ago, but missed almost the whole season with injuries in the last year. And it seemed like he was going to be one of these that just had a one good season, really, and then dropped down. But he's getting his chance again. So it'll be quite interesting to see if he plays at the turf. They've got some talented players, Palace, considering they are down there. Spironi, of course, saved that penalty at Selhurst. He's a very good goalkeeper for me. James McArthur's in their midfield as well, a player who we were linked quite heavily with in the summer. Palace paid about $6-7 million for him, so they are going to be a threat. But yeah, I just think these home games, especially with three home games against bottom six teams coming in such a short space of time, if we can win these games, I think we get well above the bottom three, and then we can take that confidence boost into the next run of fixtures, which are a bit tougher going through February and March, and they could be a long slog. So I really want us to get above that line as much as possible. One other final thing I want to touch on. We've talked about Michael King quite a lot, but he has made his permanent deal. He has turned his loan into a permanent deal, I should say, since our last podcast, I think. So we should mention him again. I was a bit surprised Manchester United were willing to sell, actually, especially for a fee that's been reported to be as low as £2 million. It seems like we've got a real bargain. I'm really amazed that we've managed to get that one done. It's a real sign of intent, isn't it, Michael?
Yeah, definitely. You want young, determined players that have an ability to grow. And he's come into the team, already shown quite quickly that his current ability, he's up there. He's already ready. He's a decent Premier League player with probably a very good future in the game ahead of him. Possible people have talked about possible England international future, and I can imagine he's got the look of a young Gary Cahill about him. And the fee, to me, if it is anything like reported, if it's down towards £2 million, I think we've got an absolute bargain. Maybe it's just that Van Gaal, when looking at his team, he likes to play three at the back sometimes. Maybe just don't feel like he needed him, maybe too far down the pecking order, and I do seem to recall Keane saying that he wanted to stay. So I think we've got a good one. Great deal.
I think, Michael, you just dealt with the player side of it, but also on the strategic side, it's a big improvement over the summer, where where our transfer activity was quite shambolic at times. Dash has obviously targeted Keane. He knows the player. I think he said in an interview it was kind of on the card since he signed on loan on deadline day. I'm kind of glad that we've almost put the summer transfer window behind us and all those failed attempts to get different players in. We put that behind us. And Dash has started this window well and gone and got quite an asset right at the beginning.
Yeah, I think it's a sign that we're going to be decisive, isn't it? I think that's really important. And even if it was sort of a clause of the loan deal, or even if it had been mentioned, I think some people have even said that we tried to buy him on deadline day, but there just wasn't time to get the deal done. I don't know if that's accurate or not. But yeah, I think the decisiveness is really key to get it done when other clubs were starting to be alerted to how good he was. I think that's important. We've struck before anyone else could sort of come in and get there first. And Michael's already mentioned Gary Cahill, but I think it's similar to Trippier and me in a way as well, in that they came in on loan, did well, and we got them signed up cheap before anyone else noticed how full potential they are. And I agree, I think Keane is potentially an England international. Adam just mentioned the summer deals that didn't happen. One of those was for Craig Dawson. In hindsight, James, maybe it's a good thing that we didn't get Dawson. Keane's probably a better player, isn't he?
Yeah, to be honest. I mean, if you look at probably what's most important for a club our size is that when you spend money on someone, you've got an opportunity of a return. And obviously with Keane, you've got that massive upside that he's only going to get better. And as a result, you know, we paid $2 million for him now. If he turns out to be sort of like, you know, we've said potentially that Gary Cahill, he's going to be worth a lot of money in the future. And you know, when you're a club our size, ultimately, when you get players in, you want to be able to sell them on for more money than you paid.
I think that's absolutely right. We need to be able to develop players as well. And I think Keane has already shown that he's got that potential to go a long way already. Compared to when he first came into the side, I think he's already come on leaps and bounds. And hopefully, assuming he stays in the side for the rest of the season, which I think we'd all agree he will do now, fitness permitting, I think we'll see how good he can be. And even if there is like an agreement in the deal that if we get relegated, we'll sell him, I think we'll still very well like the deal. It seems like almost no risk to me. If it's about £2 million, even if it's three, I think we're pretty much guaranteed to get that back in the summer if we were to go down. And if he stays, then we've got a player who's going to be excellent at championship level. So it's wins all round for me, and I'm really pleased we got that done. Just one little interesting aside. If you didn't notice, it was Keane's 22nd birthday the other day. And he shares a birthday with Michael Duff, actually. He was 15 years older than him. Duff is just about old enough to be Michael Keane's dad. Really strangely, Keane will have been 11 years old when Duff made his debut for Burnley. And I'm sure that's something that will make everyone feel quite old as we round off the podcast for this week. We will just do a quick prediction for Palace, although there's another game before then. A big home game then. Are you going to predict another win in that one as well, James?
Yeah, I'm gonna go with another win. Like I said, I think it's a really key game, and particularly after, you know, the disappointment of not getting something at Selhurst Park, I think we were really fired up for it. I'm gonna go for 3-1.
I think we can win this one as well. I'm gonna say 2-1 again, I think. What about you, Michael?
I think we need a clean sheet. I think 2-0. Quite confident. Yeah, 2-0.
Excellent. Confident stuff to round off this week's podcast. That is about all we've got time for this week. We'll be back the same time next week. Thanks to my guests Adam, James and Michael. If you do have any feedback, please do get in touch as ever. The email address is podcast@knowninever.net, and you can let us know as well if you ever want to come on and be a guest. We're always after new blood. You can tweet us as well. Our Twitter name thing is @knowninevernet. And also a final thank you to our sponsors at Neville G, without whom we couldn't do the podcast or the website or anything really. So thanks again to them. But that is all we've got time for this week. We'll see you again next time.